we took a little hiatus. I've basically been too sick to record for the past couple weeks, so I haven't been able to get this podcast out. Today's episode, I am joined by R.M. Gallardo. She is the author of Sister and the creator of the Fulton Hills Mythos. I'm so excited to have her on today. She was also a co-host on a podcast called Alone in a Room with Invisible People, one of my absolute favorite shows and a huge, huge influence on my writing system and even getting my first and subsequent books finished and written to get them ready to publish. She also currently hosts a podcast called You Killed the Priest. It is a writing prompt podcast she does with her brother, and it is just fantastic, so you should check that out. Let's get into the show. We're going to be talking about revision, why it's so important. We'll get into a little world building, and we dive a bit into contracts and some of the pros and cons of indie and traditional publishing. Welcome back to the Writing Fright podcast. I am your host and fellow writer, Tanner Rutledge, and I am joined today by someone who I've wanted to get in the podcast for a while. She was the host, one of the hosts of Alone in a Room with Invisible People. You guys have heard me cite that podcast and refer you guys to that podcast, especially pretty heavily in the original episodes. I'm joined by R.M. Gallardo, author of Sister.
Hi, welcome to the show. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on. So Sister is out, and I know a lot of the listeners here listen to Alone in a Room with Invisible People.
Yes. And yeah, that's awesome. Thank you very much for listening, by the way.
So with getting into writing, I know your mother was a writer, but when did you start writing
fiction? I was 11. So my brother picked it up a lot earlier than myself. He was already writing poems. He won a poem award at 6 years old. So he's pretty much a natural at it. I started at 11 with really, really horrible romance novels, you know, as an 11-year-old girl. The first one that I can really remember what it was called was Merriman's Arms. And it was just awful. But thankfully, my brother introduced me to horror films, all that sort of stuff. And so my love for the cryptids I grew up watching and then my love for horror started to get intermeshed.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, for the listeners who are not familiar with your work, you are the author of Sister. I would call Sister more of an urban fantasy. How did you list it when you published it?
I think I put it up there as a cult mystery, occult horror, paranormal mystery, and I know urban fantasy I put in there for sure.
There are so many subgenres now. This is not a hard horror. This, if you guys have not read the book yet, it is a fantastic example of a genre blend. So like if you like supernatural, if you like heavy horror elements with like larger storytelling, more of a fantasy format, this is a fantastic read. If you were looking to write a haunted house novel, the haunted house scenes and that side of the story in this is one of the most tightly written that I have seen from an indie author. It reminded me pretty heavily of Darcy Coates, if you like that, but it gets a little darker. It leans more towards, I'd say, Bentley Little. If you guys have been reading a lot of traditionally published authors doing research in that vein. So when you were sitting down to write Sister, where did it come from?
Well, first, the world of Fulton Hills had really started to develop when I was about 18 or 19. I know when I was 16, I started coming up with a basic idea. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or seen it. There was a show on Nickelodeon. It was called Eerie Indiana. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I watched that when I was a kid and kind of forgot about it for a little while. And then when I was about 16 or so, I started getting the idea of, well, what would this world look like? And of course, you know, we were watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel at the time and stuff like that. But Fulton Hills really started to grow on me at 19. So I started piecing together the ideas for this particular story. Originally, it was called The House on Andrews Avenue. And I had a very different main character. It was always still the bad guy. It was always still that same particular antagonist. Now, the way that I start my horror books is very different from the way I would do any of my other stories. I start with if let's say I'm writing a haunted house book, I start with the ghost, and then I find out his story and or her story, and I find out how they would come about, and then figure out how to hide that or how to maybe mislead somebody with that. But I always figure out the antagonist's story first. So I also have a weird but very common penchant for true crime. So a lot of his story came from just different elements of true crime.
That's cool. And that's something that happens a lot in mystery. So for listeners, I was a private investigator when I first got into writing. I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to write mystery novels. And then there were ghosts and vampires. But that's common in mystery, because you have to have the ending. There has to be the crime. There has to be a reason for the protagonist to get involved in the story. And you have to know what you're hiding when you're throwing in red herrings and stuff. So it's really cool that you started with the ghost and with the monster to weave it through, especially with this being an occult mystery. So that's...
Yes.
Did you research like structuring mysteries before getting into this? Did you know that's what you were doing before you did it, or was that just kind of a happy accident?
That was a happy accident. I read the books that I really love. I read a lot of nonfiction. I have read a bunch of books on writing fiction, but I have never gotten into researching specific genres. For me, I don't want to get any ideas in my head that aren't my own, or that will stilt me when it comes to actually getting the words on the page. So I would rather, if I want to research a genre, I'd rather just read in that genre and learn what the best do subconsciously as well, and then just do my own version of that.
And that's something that keeps popping up. So if you're out there and you're listening right now, you need to read in the genres that you're going to write in.
Yes. Yes, I can always tell too when somebody has not read in the genre, or has read a lot but didn't pre-plan. It did not know what their bad guy was until the very end. And it definitely leaves the reader with a big sense of disappointment, because the clues weren't there. The clues were all fake or leading in a wrong direction, not on purpose. So
there's a way to fix that.
Yes.
We've talked about it before. But before we get into fixing things like that, when it comes to the world, but Fulton Hills, the world that Sister is set in is massive. There are so many different entities, so many different, I don't want to call them corporate entities, but there are these businesses, and you can see the beginnings of some power struggles and different things that you did a really good job setting up this three-dimensional world that you can walk around
in.
Now, you said you started, you got the seeds for this at 16. You really got into it at 19. Yeah. What was your process with just building the world, and how for lack of a better word, how the magic works in the world?
Well, okay. So that's actually, there are two different things. So for building the world itself, I finally sat my ass down in button chair, as you know, a lot of people would call it, and started with Glass House, which has not yet been revised or put out. That was the first real attempt at writing a Fulton Hills book. That one is not in Fulton Hills. It's in Standing River, which is in Fulton County. But I started figuring things out then, and every single thing that could be brought up again, I put into what I call a world book. And it's just a Scrivener file with a ton of tabs, a ton of folders, a ton of different, like anytime a business is mentioned, it goes in the world book. Anytime a new character is mentioned, it will go in the world book. It is a lot of work, but it does make it a lot easier to retain the information instead of having to go dig out your old manuscript or old books and find something. With how the magic works, there's like certain things that I can't say just yet, because as the books grow, you guys are going to be able to start to see where the magic actually comes from. And I want to make it a very, very clear entity in and of itself, the magic. And it does work differently for different people, different types of people, and it will show just why and how. I think book one started off very lightly with the magic. It's just basically cryptids and ghosts and the crystal work. But book two is going to have even more, and it's going to evolve from there. And the magic itself took a lot of research as far as looking into how different cultures approach magic, but also how the natural world works. So it's sort of a mix between the two. And as you progress through the books, you will definitely start to see. I think a lot of people will it'll click in their heads like, ah, you know, like they'll start to see something that most people might miss until the very end.
That's cool. I love it when it's layered like that. Like a good mystery is solvable halfway through the book if you pay attention. And if it's an ongoing mystery through a series, you should catch that pretty early if your mind works like that.
Yeah.
If you've been paying attention. So it's really cool that that's how you're thinking, because that's how mysteries are written. And I know you've talked about it on your podcast with adding layers of mystery, because when I was actually going back and doing revisions for Haynes, I kicked back to that mystery, the mystery episode that you guys did, just to go back through it to find out how to layer it and how to restructure that. So it's just really cool the way that you've done it. Now, getting into what you just talked about, where you can tell when somebody didn't figure out an entity until the end of a book. Mm-hmm. So recently when I was going through and I was writing Haynes, I had that where I was like, okay, this bad guy sucks. And I flipped it, but you can fix it.
Yes.
If you revise it and you go back and you put the right things in there. There are so many people that do not revise their novels, or just like kind of, maybe they don't know what they're doing, or maybe they're just like, nope, I just want to get it out there and see what happens.
But my guess is that they don't know what a revision is versus the edit process.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Let's get into that. So a revision versus edit.
Well, this is something that I know that we talked about on Alone in a Room with Invisible People, although we did like 120 something episodes, so I don't remember which one or anything like that. But it's such an important thing that I know we've talked about it again and again. Revision is such an important thing that literally the very last page of my book, under the about the author area, I put a link to Holly's course on how to revise, you know, novels and stuff. It is, and whether you take that course or not, it does not matter. It's what it is revision is the opportunity to make that book that you just wrote what it was intended to be. Editing is going back and looking for typos and misspellings, bad grammar, basic stuff like that. So the revision is huge, especially if you want that inflow first draft experience where you have trained yourself to sit in front of a typewriter, computer, word processor, whatever you're using, and just type and just be in that world and not worry about typos and not worry about keeping things not only consistent, but also not have to worry about using more appropriate language as far as how you want your style to go. First draft is for you, the writer, to get the bare bones of that story down. Revision is where you go in and you make all the magic happen, at least in my mind. That's where revision to me is where I go back and I start looking for all of what we call toys on the floor, which is something that is just sparking your imagination from something that your right brain put on paper that you didn't even realize was there. But it's where you go back and you find two scenes that were, one was really fun, one was info dump. How can I put these two scenes together where there's no more info dump, but all of the information comes in this really fun scene so that I can blend it. You know, it's where you find better ways to hide that mystery or to maybe beef up the chemistry between two characters.
And when you're reading through and you're doing the revisions,
you're going to see stuff that you might have put down subconsciously, or these connections between things that you didn't even know existed that really bring the story to life, because your characters are doing things behind your back while you're writing, and you don't see it until you go back. Yeah. That's the best part of writing. It's like, oh, I didn't know Dylan did that. I didn't know Mercedes did that.
They pop up and they do these strange things, or they refer to things that, you know, and especially like you said, in the moment, in the flow, you're unaware. And as you're going back, especially if you've given it a little bit of time to cool down, you have so much more to play with and so much more depth that you can add during a revision.
You know, especially on a first novel, going back after you finally complete it, you write in horror, I think most people are shooting for between 55,000 and 80,000 words, tight stories. You finish that, maybe you write a couple of short stories. With the Haint was my first novel. I got so much better between the day one and finishing that, and then going back through the revisions. The second part, like the last 25% of my novel, looked like somebody else completely different wrote the book. You got to go back through and even it. So like my revision process was going back through rereading and then just evening out the writing and then going through and bringing out the characters. And then I found this book, Structuring Your Novel by K.M. Wellen. And I'm going back and putting more structure into the story. Yeah. And I actually found a major, like something broke my story. And I don't want to get into it because it's a major spoiler. But I was reading this book on structure and it just clicked on what would fix that. And had I not revised that, I could have finished this and polished it and put it out there and had a broken story that people hated. And maybe I made a little bit of money and maybe I didn't.
Yeah.
Be ready to rewrite your book 5 times.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's... I think that was what really sealed it for me with my mom's classes, because I will tell you, it is the most gruesome course she offers in terms of work, but you only do the revision once. I have written a slew in, oh God, I'm not going to age myself by saying how many years I've been writing, but it's been a long time. The only way that you can do it and that you can get good is that you have to write bad. So if you're brand new, it's just start writing. You don't have to share it with anybody. Just start writing and write everything all the time. Whatever your ideas come, you know, they will get better. But revision is, it's magic to me now. Like if you had talked to me 10 years ago, I would have been like, I hate revision. I absolutely hate revision. But after taking the course, after having gone through it with 3 books now, I love revision because you can make it the book that it always should have been. The initial inspiration that got you writing in the first place, this amazing idea for a story, and you can make it better and better and better through revision. And it doesn't matter what process you use. You don't have to use that particular course. As long as your end goal is find everything that's wrong, find everything that's right, fix everything that's wrong, and make everything that's right better and put more of it into every scene. You can put your hidden gems in a scene. There is one. So I think that you've gone through a decent amount of Sister. What is the scene that you ended on that you remember?
They are about to go into what I believe is the final conflict. So I'm like right at the climax. I'll be finishing it up tonight.
Okay. So I can't use that one as an example. Well, there's little things in the book, and if you reread it, it'll poke up. Like you'll notice, like, oh, she said this about this character, and then at the end, this thing happened. Some of that was intentional and some of that was not. A lot of the times, if you have a really strong sense of your characters, and then as you're writing, you know, even if they change, if you have a strong sense of these characters, when you go back through and you revise, you can take out the character dumps, take out the, you know, the descriptions of, you know, certain aspects of them, and just make them act a certain way that will lead to plot twists, or will lead to conflict in a very natural way, or that will make a situation worse. And that's a big thing that I think revision can help a lot of people with, is making the characters more realistic and relatable, making their like the dynamics between characters, their own actions. Those are the things that revision can really help and help tighten up as well. As well as, you know, the story and trying to hide certain aspects or, you know, reveal very slowly different things.
It's like sculpting.
Yeah.
When you rough out, like say you're, it doesn't matter if it's clay, it doesn't matter if it's wood. We're sculpting stories. We're sculpting worlds. And we go over it in that first glance and we rough it out. So it looks kind of like what it's going to look like at the end. But if you're making a statue, it's not chiseled. It's not, you don't have the features rounded. You don't have the facial hair, the grain, the pores, the folds of the clothing, whatever you're trying to make. It's not finished until it's revised. It's not ready to go out and be seen by the world until it's polished. And that's revision.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, revision is what's going to make your story really pop, as long as you, and, you know, have some other people look at it and read it and take, you know, try, especially if you're lucky enough to have a grammar Nazi as a friend. Oh man, it might be rough hearing all of the places that you did things wrong. I have a grammar Nazi friend who is also an Oxford comma nerd. Mm-hmm. And I always forget those extra commas. So by the end of the book, she was like, "Dear God, please, Oxford comma," just all caps. And it was like, oh God.
There's so many memes. It's like an Oxford comma is the difference between, was it, we're having the kids for dinner and we're having the kids for dinner. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I love that. I love that. And it's a lot of it is that left brain, right brain thing, right? Like you're writing in right brain and then you're editing and revising, and you tend to think it's all left brain, but revision can also be right brain. And I think that once you have that flow, you're going to get a really good story out of it. And I wish I could use specific examples, but again, I don't want to mention anything that might take away from your personal, you know, feelings towards my book, because I am interested in
we try to stay away from spoilers altogether, just because I don't want to spoil it for the listeners either, because the hope is that, like, they'll take when we're talking about these examples and we're talking about the writing. I listen to a lot of literary podcasts, and this is part of how I learned how to write, was I would listen to them talk about how they wrote the book, and then I would go read the book.
Yes.
To tie it all together. So that's the hope that people will do that, to learn how to do this in the indie world, because there's so many resources out there for getting traditionally published, and interviews with traditional authors and with large presses and how it's done there. Hoping that this can be a resource for the indie world and the future of writing, because pretty much everything is going small press and self-published these days.
For good reason too.
Yep.
For a lot of good reason. So yeah, that's like, the idea is that if you put out something that is your best work and your people start finding you, your new books will sell your old books. So like your new work will sell your backlist, and then you just keep building on in that way. It's just like, keep giving your people more books and more people will find you and become your people. So that's what I'm really hoping for. But I found that Heirloom, so Sister was the most complex story that I had written up to the date of writing that one. Heirloom is even more complex. So my wish to have it published again, September 25th, so that people could have it for spooky season of 2021, did not work. It will be published for 2022. Heirloom is another haunted house story, but again, it's more complex than Sister itself is. So
yeah, you pulled it off really well. I was hoping that you would do more in the haunted house vein. I'm looking forward to the cryptid stuff to come too.
Yes, this one will have a little bit of that in it too. The Wargath, since you did read it, I want everybody to, you know, if anybody does read the book, let me know what you think of the different elements that are in there. I would love to hear from anybody about the book, and especially if I think we've found most of the typos, but again, if you have any opinions, let me know, because you're all going to be writers that are going to be listening. So we have to stick together.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Guys, if you see something, feel free. Like, this is like, what I like about indie writing too, is it's open source. And once you publish a book, you don't have to be done with it. Like, there's a lot of authors now that are doing authors preferred editions, authors favorite editions, updated, new and improved version 2.0.
Yes. Well, like we talked about before we actually recorded anything, it's when Heirloom comes out, there will be an updated revised vision of Sister, just because of all of the little issues that I unfortunately overlooked.
And we had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, RJ Lewis. We talked about the Muse, and I believe his updated version of Muse is out. So like that's cool. An example of one of those, like, you can always update. Especially
I was just gonna say, I think that there's like a really good balance to be made. Like, you have control of this. This is your baby. All of your writing is your thing. So you are always in control. That's the beauty of indie publishing. But there's a balance to be made between becoming obsessed with making something perfect, which is impossible, and giving people what they need, which is, you know, better grammar, no typos, you know, less mistakes. Anything that people complain about with a very, very legitimate reason can be fixed, but you don't want to get so tied down into perfection or the search for that ever elusive perfection that does not exist, that you neglect writing the next book and the next book. You know, you want to dedicate more time to creating more than trying to fix old.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing is very common with independent writers and with us, editing's expensive. So like I've got the budget together for the Haints and I've found my editors, and I am looking at a minimum to get just the minimum pass-throughs, $2,100 for editing.
Oh, wow. That's
a developmental editing. I was a copywriter. I've done a lot of stuff. I was a copywriter. I'm good with line stuff. So I'm doing my own line edit, but then it's also going through for a copy and a proofread.
Yeah.
So one pass through developmental, and then a copy and a proofread, $2,100.
Yeah. That's, it's not inexpensive. It is not cheap. My husband doesn't like that word. he prefers inexpensive. It is not cheap or inexpensive to be an indie published author, which I think, at least to have a quality product at the end.
Yeah. And a lot of people, like, I was super surprised that David Sodergren, he does all of his own editing. He uses beta readers. And I've noticed that everyone that does not go with hiring an editor relies heavily on beta readers. So that is mm-hmm. one way to get it out. But I've noticed the guys that have been in the game for 15 or 20 years that are making a good living at this now, they're going back to those first books that they released, and they're getting their current editors to go through and do edits.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And they're re-releasing them. Like, everybody I've talked to that has been in the game. And then, guys, it does take a while to build a backlist. It takes mm-hmm. a while to get a following. So like traditional authors, I have noticed 6 to 10 years of writing before they hit that contract, and about 4 books in before they have a chance at their breakout.
Yeah. And that's, like you said, traditionally published. So 4 books, and that's with people, big publishing houses that are pushing these books to mm-hmm. different bookstores, and like all the ads that you're going to see online and in social media and everything like that. A lot of that too. Remember, if you're looking at traditional publication, the publishers, and this is still something that I've noticed happens to this day, does not set you up for specific interviews. They might help. You know, it might also help to throw out the name of the traditionally published, you know, or the publisher that you're working under, but you are still the one that is in charge of going to do the blog spots, the podcast interviews. A lot of them will have to push themselves into marketing. They don't help very much with marketing, except for the fact that, yeah, okay, you're going to have 2 or 3 books in bookstores mm-hmm. in certain chains, but we all know the bookstores aren't going to be. There aren't as many as there used to be anymore. So how much is that really helping?
Yep, absolutely. And with being indie, I mean, you pretty much got to do the same thing anyway. The timelines mm-hmm. are similar. Like, you're, as an indie, you're going to get out 15 to 20 books before you hit and get like a good backlist. So you're looking at still about a decade before you launch, a lot of times, just kind of standard average going through there. But you're still going to have to do all that stuff that you were. And you can negotiate getting on bookstore shelves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. So how much is that traditional publisher with a big name really helping if you can find a way into bookstores in the first place. You know, it's how much is it worth it for them to pay you a very small advance and then ridiculously tiny royalties versus you earning it all yourself.
So yeah, getting your stuff onto bookshelves in bookstores, it takes some time. And I think a lot of horror authors, specifically in this genre, and it does vary from genre to genre. Mystery writers tend to do very well going traditional. They tend to do also pretty well on indie side. Yep. With horror, we are a niche genre. Most of us at some point are going to be hybrid. We're going to have some of our own stuff out, and then we're going to have some stuff with small presses, or we're going to have some stuff with imprints like Tor's New Nightfire. That's just part of it. The big thing there, like I think you're planning on doing the same thing where you're writing all of your books in the same world.
Yeah.
I'm doing the same thing. All of my books are set in this world, in this Southern Gothic haunted Appalachian mountain.
That sounds amazing.
Not Stephen King. Most of his books are in the same world or the same two worlds. A lot of authors do this, and a lot of guys are kind of shy about pursuing traditional contracts or going with small presses because they're worried about losing the rights to their world because they spend so much time on the world building. Mm-hmm. Those are subsidiary rights. You can negotiate that.
Yes.
From what I have heard from agents, from what I have heard from authors who have had traditional publications, most places, like your big, big publishers, are willing to negotiate away about 50% of the subsidiary rights.
Right now, things are so heavily skewed in the favor of the indies that it really is your best shot at getting the best contract for yourself. If you get the opportunity to go for a traditional publication, I do say, please take a look at the contract with somebody who can read contracts. A, B, if the contract, if the publisher who initiates that contract, if they are to go out of business and somebody buys that publication, they buy that company, they are at no obligation whatsoever to fulfill those contracts. So that is how my mother, Holly Lyle, traditional published author, how she lost the rights to the secret text, and she will never get them back because a company bought that company as it was going out of business. Her rights should have right around the time that they should have reverted back to her or given her the chance to buy those books back. The company null and void all contracts. So there is always a risk. However, if you are somebody who has a bunch of different worlds or can create offshoots of particular worlds that you're okay with selling to, you know, and, you know, still negotiate the best contract you possibly can, because right now is the best chance you can for negotiating something that is more writer, more creative friendly because of the way the industry is moving. But, you know, there's the pros and cons. There are always pros and cons to it. There are always chances that were unforeseen things that could possibly happen, like a company going out of business. I doubt Penguin or Tor or any of the other major companies are going to go out of business anytime soon. So it depends on what you're writing. But I don't know. There's actually another world that I do write in occasionally. This is a zombie series that I've been working on again since I think I was 14 when I wrote the first part of it. And this is not going to come out until it's all done, all complete. It's all going to be underneath, you know, my indie whatever. And I'm going to release it all pretty much book after book after book. So it's just all going to come out in one go. I can't even imagine going traditional with that. However, I am highly, highly biased. I could be coming off as incredibly negative about the traditional publishing route. So if you're listening to this, understand that I grew up in a house where we struggled, despite the fact that my mother was writing what her publisher wanted, which was a book a year, every single year. And we struggled to the point where we weren't even sure if we were going to have a home, if we were going to have rent, food on the table, electricity, all of that stuff, despite the fact that she was constantly outselling what they said was required. So I am coming from a very biased background. Don't let my bias destroy any hopes that you might have to be traditionally published. Just go with care and make sure to read the contracts.
A lot of this comes to with doing due diligence on who you are signing with. If you go for a traditional contract, whether it's a big name or a small press, Writing Fright Press, I am launching the magazine next year, and I am opening that as a small press. So I will be
awesome.
Publishing a few other authors and putting stuff together. Do your due diligence on publishers.
Yes.
The horror show with Brian King. You want to Brian King. You want to find some publishers that you don't want to work with.
Yeah.
Eat out everybody.
Yeah.
That
is a really good resource. Yeah. I was gonna say, like, even then though, like back in the day, Alora's Cave was like the place to publish your. It was like a small press that was kind of far more indie allowancing. So Alora's Cave was like this huge thing where all these romance writers and erotica writers would put their stuff, and then they just stopped paying out of the blue, just stopped paying people. People stopped getting royalties. Then they shut down. Then, I mean, there's this huge controversy. You can look it up on, you know, you can Google it, but it's just, you never know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like he said, do your due diligence, look everybody up, make sure you look over a contract with somebody who can read contracts, make sure that you negotiate that contract. Usually agents are going to be all in the favor of their writer. If you get a decent agent, they're going to want to make sure to get you as much as they can, because it means a happier writer and more money for them too.
Yeah. And check those guys out at the Horror Writers Association. There's a list of people that have been vetted that have represented, really good authors and have negotiated good contracts for the authors. And they are there on the, as a resource, if you're a member at the Horror Writers Association. Before I hire an editor, before I do anything, I always go there, because there are also discounts for editors. Yeah. And there are different things for association members. So absolutely sign up there. And whenever you get a contract, ask around, ask other authors, and try to find people that have worked with that publisher. And look at the subsidiary rights. Look at foreign rights. Look at your rights to your characters or your world, because you don't want a publishing company to be able to take your characters and launch something else with it without your creative control. And don't be afraid to walk away. A lot of us are so hungry, and we want that contract so much, and we want to get our books out and get the best product out, and we sign away our souls.
Yeah.
Just got an idea for a new book. But we do.
It really does come from anywhere,
right?
Yeah.
Like my next book, after the Haint, the Tasting. The Tasting has a mass market appeal. I think that would do well with the general public and with like general population horror readers. So that one I am looking to place traditionally, not necessarily with a big press, but maybe with one of the larger small press. But I feel comfortable putting that out myself, and I'll walk away from a contract that I don't like.
Yeah.
And you have to do the same.
A lot of people, even if they're more pragmatic, right? Like you're sitting there, you're thinking, well, I know my first book isn't going to be Stephen King, you know, that's not going to blow up like he did, or Stephanie Meyer, or whoever it is that you're reading, and that, you know, that was not a horror book reference there. I'm just saying, cause she blew up really big, very quickly. A lot of people can be very pragmatic, but they say they want the credibility. I want the credibility of a traditionally published book. And I've been there. I wanted that too. I submitted Leaving Monda Lucia, which was the romance that I wrote in like 2016 or 17, to Silhouette. And unfortunately, it was too similar to a lot of the books they had currently. I think they had a lot of stalker books coming out, and I had written a stalker book. She told me, please submit something else. I didn't. I really wanted that credibility, because if you can get traditionally published, then it's like, I could be published with this other company, but I'm doing it myself. But hey, look, I am published as well. Like, but again, you have to know whether or not the contract is right for you, and credibility is not worth losing a world or a bunch of characters or the rights to the book eventually when the publication rights are done. You still want to get that book back.
Also, you're going to want to look at like how what's the revision and what constitutes a violation of the contract. Yes. I was in a writer's group. Some of you guys might have seen it. It was on the Facebook groups. Somebody was asking what they should do because they won a writing contest 3 years ago. The book has not come out and the publisher changed the terms of the contract.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
There's
no reason winning a writing contest, the most they should have had one first publication rights for a year. That's it.
And if you want a really good resource on how a traditional contract is laid out, the Ghostwriters podcast. If you guys listen to the horror show, basically everybody minus Brian Keene,
for the most part,
went over to the Ghostwriters podcast. Mary Sangiovanni,
Summer Cannon,
Matt, Dave, all of those guys were over there, and they talk about contracts, and they talk about different aspects of writing and publishing in the traditional world and in the small press world. So if you want a detailed dive into what a contract looks like, Mary pulls out one of her contracts and goes through it and talks about what to look for and what to X out so that you can represent yourself and read your contracts.
That's an incredible resource.
Yeah, it's an awesome resource. Thank you so much for coming on today, guys. If you have not already, head over to Amazon. Is Sister still on Kindle?
Kindle Unlimited. Yeah. So it's free or it's $2.99 if you want to buy it, either way.
Yeah.
Or $9.99 if you want the paperback.
Sweet. Fantastic book, guys. Go check it out. And we will see you next week.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for coming on. And thank you for your podcast. When I started writing, I would not have finished. I've actually written full on two books, working on book three now because of what I learned in that podcast with sitting down and getting my butt in the chair and my fingers on the keyboard.
That's amazing. I've had so many people. This was the best thing. Okay. I just want to put two things. I also wanted to plug another thing. My brother and I have a podcast called You Killed the Priest. It's just for fun. We don't put out episodes a whole bunch. We were trying it weekly. It didn't work out because he's got some issues with the VA and he's got some personal stuff going on, but it's just writing to prompts. And so it's a lot of fun. It's just brother and sister shenanigans. And then also stories and prompts and stuff. If you want to listen, that'd be great. The best thing, the second thing I wanted to say was the best thing I got from writing or working with my mom with you, Alone in a Room with Invisible People, was all of the people, everybody coming and saying, this episode completely changed my mind on something, like, or this episode completely opened my eyes to what I'm doing wrong. I have talked to so many people that have listened to that podcast. You guys have no idea. If you are one of the listeners, shoot me an email. Let me know, you know, that something helped you. It is the most amazing feeling in the world to have been able to help anybody at all figure something out with writing, because it is not a natural inborn talent. It's not a God-given gift. It is an absolute 100% skill that anybody can learn. And I hope that that podcast goes on indefinitely and helps everybody who wants to be a writer.
I'm glad it's still up because I still go back to it for a resource. So where can people find you? Social media and email if you want them to email you.
Oh yeah. You feel free to email me. The email is Rebecca@RebeccaGallardo.com. My name is spelled like it sound, but I know some people have a problem with it. So it's, the last name is GALARDO. So just Rebecca@RebeccaGallardo.com. You can find me on Instagram, I guess, mostly it's RMGALARDO. And, yeah, I mostly just post about plants, chickens, cats, and sometimes my writing and stuff. So we accidentally got chickens this year. So it's been a journey.
Cool. We will link to those in the show notes.
And thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on and all the resources that you've done for new writers.
Yeah, no problem. I hope this episode does really well. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you all so much for tuning in for this episode. If you have any questions or you would like to connect with the podcast to ask questions of your favorite authors, you can email me at writingfright@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Instagram and Facebook at writingfright. So I will see you guys next week, and we'll have a regular episode that I wanted to get out, but due to illness was not able to get out last week. going over some of the stuff that has happened with the Haints and some of my my future projects that are coming up with, fingers crossed, announcing a release date.